And thanks to everybody else again who read. Appreciate helping us start the meeting. And welcome to those that have joined us since we first started. And we'd like to welcome any newcomers and any visitors, and particularly any newcomers to our meeting this evening. We're glad you're here. And we hope you hear something in the meeting tonight that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So thank you. And we do have a speaker tonight, and it falls for me to introduce them. And this gives me a great deal of pleasure, actually, to introduce this particular individual. We've known each other for, I think, probably 5 years, maybe longer. I forget now what it was. And he's become a really important part of my recovery. Kind of a bit of a funny story, really, is that I'd met this person on the internet and kind of liked what I was hearing and decided to ask them to be my sponsor. And they'd invited me over to the mainland to go and share at a convention. And the night before I was about to fly out, they phoned me up and asked me to sponsor them. So that was an interesting experience. And we had the conversation, and actually we've become very close over the last few years. And it works for us. And I love him to bits. So, Michael, without further ado, I'm going to ask you if you would please share with us your experience, strength, and hope. Thank you.
Thank you for... I'm an addict. Take me, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
At first, I was nervous, and now I'm a little emotional. I thank you for your service, Steve, and you know, I don't get that emotional that often. And when I do, it's because something deep inside of me tells me that I am valued. And when I came to, you know, the funniest thing was all my life, that's all I wanted, was to feel valued, be wanted and needed. I knew I was loved, but everything else in those components just didn't seem to come along until I came to Narcotics Anonymous. And what's really interesting was the fact that this particular group made me feel the most love I felt in years. And the irony is, I've met almost all of you online. So I'm just grateful for all of you to be here tonight. And I'm grateful to be, and like I said, I'm an addict and I'm clean, and it's possibly the one great thing I could say. And the testimony comes from Narcotics Anonymous. It certainly wasn't something I imagined I could do. You know, the funniest thing is I celebrate 32 years on the 19th of June. And what's really weird was I just found out recently that there's a celebration in the United States called Juneteenth, which was the abolition of slavery in the United States. And the day, and I didn't pick that date, I didn't pull it out of the hat. I just picked that date because that just felt right. And until recently, I never knew that that was the day of the abolition of slavery in the United States. And, you know, I thought that was probably the most poignant date. It just means so much more to me now than it ever been. As my sponsor has alluded to, the thing is, if it wasn't for that clean date, I wouldn't be celebrating my birthdays. When I got to Narcotics Anonymous, I didn't think for 2 seconds I was going to live past the age of 30. And, you know, that just blows me away that I came from a very, I wouldn't say, I came from a family that was not necessarily happy. I think they were more relieved to be in California. I was born in August 3rd, 1962, if anybody needs context. And I was born in Sacramento, California at 5:30 in the morning. And I have to say, I'm really nervous, so please forgive me. So please bear with me. I'm grateful that I could still get nervous doing these things as well. So when I was born in Sacramento, as I said before. My parents came from South Carolina. And if anybody knows the history of the United States, you know that, and just to give you context, I'm a black man. Where my parents came from, there was a lot of racism going on in where they lived. My mother was highly educated. My father was, you know, there was just the feelings of what they experienced was so rife. And my uncle moved from where Louisiana to Sacramento, California, and my father decided to follow suit. And I tell you this part because even though they left the physical place that where they felt that anger, the anger didn't go away. And when they moved, they brought that anger with them. And all their life, they just felt, I mean, it was just like they felt that sense of what they left behind and those scars that just kind of those wounds that they thought that they could leave behind. And so I grew up in a house full of real undercurrent of rage all the time. And until recently, I didn't know what it was or why they were like that until I saw a documentary about something that pertained to, and I don't even remember who it was that made this documentary, but it just kind of answered a lot of questions that I had about my family. Anyway, I'm one of six children and one of four surviving children. I had two brothers that died when I was very young. And I didn't know how to process that death. I really didn't know because I had counselors come and talk to me about it, but I didn't know what, I mean, I was just completely frozen with feelings and all sorts of stuff going on. And I just realized, and the one thing that got me out of those feelings was Coca-Cola. And I realized that just numbed the pain just enough. Just enough so I could not feel. And when I was a kid, I used to buy these 8-packs and glass bottles of Coca-Cola, and my brothers and sisters used to drink from them. One of the things was I didn't like to share my Coca-Cola. And so I started to do this thing where I hid stuff around the house so they wouldn't find it, and they would wonder what happened to all the Coca-Cola, and I would just go, I don't know. I became a very either good liar or bad actor. I don't quite know which, but that I think was my earliest memory of addiction, what an addict does. My very first drug I ever had was beer in a Melmac cup my father gave me just so I can go to sleep. And that did the trick. It also opened I'm not quite sure what I'm trying to say there. But it opened that door to other things. And from that point on, I realized that alcohol was a great fix. And when I was 15 years old, I came out of the closet. and I discovered marijuana. But I also discovered a bunch of people that I thought I could relate with, and later on in my life, I didn't relate to them. And the funniest thing was, I mean, I met my, other gay men, and I didn't really particularly like them because I didn't quite fit into that little scenario. I tried my damnedest, and I really couldn't fit in. And all my life, I tried to fit into some sort of circle that would, have me be a member, and never could fit in anywhere. When I started taking drugs, I started to fit in. When I turned 20, when I dropped out of high school, bound and determined never to return because I don't really think I'm too smart for this shit, actually. I just really couldn't stand high school. I was completely not happy with high school. And I wanted out, and I wanted to grow up, and I wanted to be adult. Oh, and kind of give you the context. When I first came out of the closet, I actually started to do this thing. I used to run away from home so I could find myself. And it was this great line from Easy Rider, where they're describing the two bikers on there. They were looking for America and couldn't find it anywhere. That was what I was feeling about myself. And it was like I looked for myself and couldn't find it anywhere until I got to Narcotics Anonymous. And I'll get more into that in a little bit. So I basically found I pretty much floundered for like 2 years, and then I found this group of very weird people, and I'm going to use air quotes there, that they looked like that they just didn't fit in either, at this coffee shop, and I was like, this is the place for me. I found my tribe. Because almost everybody knew I was gay, everybody knew I was black, it was pretty obvious, but they accepted me. I had finally found a bunch of people, a bunch of punk rockers and skinheads, and I found this motley crew of mods, and I decided to hang out with them and go to their gigs, and I found solace in that. And with that came narcotics. And I found also within that group, I found the artistic crowd that also did what they did, and they really were quite accepting of the weird, the bizarre, the odd socks, and I was just a hanger on. I wasn't a creative. As of yet, I just hung on. That scene lasted only 3 or 4 years before it kind of disbanded because the cafe closed and almost everybody decided to do other things. I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, as the party just kind of weighing down, I was ready to party some more. And this time I wound up going to more and more drugs of any sort I could get my hands on. When I found crystal meth, I really, really loved it. I mean, it did everything I wanted to do. And that didn't even last long. Maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe 2 years at the very most. But what it did to me was it alienated my family. I mean, I already alienated them way before I ever, started coming out. I mean, just me coming out of the closet alienated them. But I mean, the drugs really alienated me. I mean, I was kicked out of my mom's house and living underneath other people's houses and thinking to myself, well, I'm going to just end my life, and I didn't have the guts to do it. Somewhere along the way, I found jobs, some really, I knew how to get a job. I just didn't know, I would probably keep a job for like 6 months and then I'd be fired for some unknown reason. My life was just, I mean, everything in my life was just completely endless, and the shit that was going down was endless and endless and endless. And this time I didn't have my mother or my sister or my brother, my siblings to kind of back me up. I just sort of had to do it on my own, and all the friends that I kind of didn't used up were kind of sick of my shit. One day, on June 4th, 1988, and I can remember this date because it, for no other reason except I remember it was hot. I remember I was working at a department store, and I was late because I was using the night before, and I always prided myself on never be late. Well, I was late that day, and I was really pissed off with myself, and I was strung out, and I couldn't take it 1 second longer. And this friend of mine who I'd known for years, and who's currently still one of my Facebook friends, and we talk every once in a while, see how we're doing. He asked me, "How's it going, Michael?" And I used to party with this guy too. And I told him that I was having a really bad day and whatnot. And he was listening. He listened to I was having a bad day, and he nodded, and he kind of had that look on his face like he was really trying to listen very intently. And he said the lines that I've never forgotten: "I don't know if I can help you, but I know a place that could." And so at the time, Sacramento was a very small fellowship. It was just starting. I went to my very first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, and I was very, very skeptical. I was very scared. And the two things that kind of came from my first meeting was, or many different things, but one of the things I saw most people said, "Welcome here and keep coming back." And I thought to myself, "Why do you want me to come back?" The second thought was everyone was happy and I was really fucking miserable. But I sat at that meeting and I don't think I heard a single thing that was said at that meeting. And they just told me to get a meeting schedule, find some, work the steps and find a sponsor, work the steps, all the catchphrases that we use a lot. And it didn't stick at that time. I remember going to a party and having a joint and thinking to myself, and there was this girl that I met in recovery, and she gave me that look, that same visceral look that my parents gave me of complete and utter disappointment. And I remembered that look, and I remembered that girl's look got me back into the fellowship. I wish it was grand and glorious, I shut up heroin and whatnot. Well, I'll get to that probably. I don't know. So I ran to the next meeting I could possibly get to, but at the time, Narcotics Anonymous was really small and was completely spread out. And a friend of mine told me about this meeting hall that was down the street from where I lived, and it just happened to be say, Alcoholics AA meeting hall, because it is mentioned in our basic text. And I stayed at that meeting hall, and there were the same kind of people that I used to hang out with: the misfits, the freaks, the people that were kind of forgotten about. But I found home there too, and out of all that, for 18 months, I did everything. I mean, I'm very grateful for that fellowship. They taught me how to do service, get a sponsor, and read the basic text, their basic text, which I never liked, and I still, to this very day, do not like it. Because it doesn't really, I didn't relate to me at all. And my friend at the time was this girl named Joyce, and Joyce was also going to Narcotics Anonymous. And she was, so I basically came back to Narcotics Anonymous via service, doing service, because we did the American River Area Unity Day. And she got me on the service committee as a merchandise chair. And I went, I didn't know what a merchandise chair was, and she just told me, just come to meetings with me and it'll be no problem. Well, it kind of felt really odd for me to go to another 12-step program and but yet go to this particular 12-step program and do service for this other one, do service for Narcotics Anonymous. So basically, what I had to do was go to NA meetings. And there was this meeting that actually just cropped up. It was on 27th and P Street, or maybe it was 29th and P. And there was this person there named John who said, "Welcome here. I'm glad you're here." And I never felt, and up until that time, until I, that little coffee shop that I felt welcomed at, I'd not felt that welcomed. He didn't look like me. He wasn't gay. But he was really, really wonderful to me. And so was the rest of that group. And I'll give you another piece of context is, it was predominantly a biker kind of biker kind of mentality group, bunch of people. They all dressed in colors and whatnot. And then I went to other meetings where there were people who was of Latin derivation, and then I went to meetings where primarily black. But they all said the same thing. It's like, keep coming back, get a sponsor, work the steps, and you will find this freedom. But there was something else that somebody said in a meeting that I really hold on to this very day. And that was, keep coming, find somebody you can connect with. And that was the reason why me and Joyce were so tight, and then me and my best friend Vicky were so tight. There was no, me and Joyce went to all sorts of meetings all over the place. As a matter of fact, my very first world convention, my very first convention was the World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous in Portland, Oregon. And I totally freaked out because there were so many people. And then at one point, Joyce talked me off the fence. I was 2 years clean, and Joyce talked me off the fence saying, "Michael, there are people like you there." And I said, "Oh, okay." I mean, I calmed down enough. And I remember hearing this, going to the main speaker meeting, and there was this guy named Bob B, and he was very controversial. And I said to myself, "I gotta meet this character." And I did meet him when I moved to San Francisco years down the road. But basically what I did do was I got an NA sponsor. I started going to NA meetings. I started doing, I mean, completely forgot. As much as I loved that AA home group, I found home in NA. Because one of the things I found really interesting about it, like that coffee shop with the punk rockers there, I was accepted without being, I mean, I'm not saying I wasn't judged, but I was accepted. Unconditional acceptance of being a member of Narcotics Anonymous because I was an addict. And for the first 6.5 years of my recovery, I went to meetings all of the time, and I've gotten into service. And I'm kind of addicted to doing area service, and I realized that moment, that's where I feel the most comfortable. About 1994, I had an opportunity to move to San Francisco with my best friend, which one of my closest friends, one of my big supporters in recovery, and she was not an addict. And at that time, it was really scary for me because I've always lived in Sacramento. But one of my bucket list thing, I had only three things in my bucket list at the time in my life, that I wanted to go on a game show, work at Macy's, and move to San Francisco. Oh, and go to Paris. And since I've been clean, all those things have happened, by the way. But I needed to get out of my comfort zone. That's what I needed to do. And so lo and behold, I had an opportunity to move to San Francisco. And I met the person that I spent my first, 10 years of my recovery was with, somebody that I met in San Francisco about 6 months after, or 3 months after I moved there. And we dated for a little bit, and then he wanted me to move in. And as we were going to meetings, he stopped going to meetings. He was an addict too, but he stopped going to meetings for whatever reasons he did, and I kept going. And then at one point, I stopped going to meetings. And that was probably 6 months of the most craziest behavior I ever gone through. I didn't even, and it dawned on me that I wasn't living the program. I was not even practicing the steps. I wasn't practicing, I was at that mentality. Yeah, I'm powerless, but once I do this, my life will get together. My life, I can handle this. Never thought about the second step or any step beyond that. And but once I got wind of what was going on, I called my old sponsor, who later moved away. I called him up and told him, I'm absolutely fucking insane. This man's driving me crazy, and da 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 da. And the next thing he asked me was, well, what are you going to do about it? And it's like, well, I don't know. What do I do about it? Here's a guy who has, 8 or 9 years clean, and couldn't, and as fucking crazy as possible. My head came out of my ass at 5 years clean, and suddenly reality hit that, oh my God, it isn't what, I'm not happy. I'm at a job I can't stand. I'm with people, I'm surrounded by people I just hate and whatnot. And one of the things my sponsor suggested to me, or my ex-sponsor suggested to me, is find a sponsor you can listen to and hear. And you can instantly, if you can relate with them, it doesn't have to be like you, it's just somebody you can hear. And so I finally found one. And it is this fantastic woman by the name of Billy. And Billy was, I'm going to just say this, and this is high praise. She was the most cantankerous bitch you had ever meet in your life. She did not pull punches. She did not make say things to make you feel good. She only said things to make you look at yourself. And when she told me, you get back to step one, you admit how powerless you are, and how you're how this is making your life incredible hell, then you are going, and once you get through that, once you get that one rock solid under your skin, then you get to step two. And you turn that your will and life over to make a decision, and I had no idea how to make a decision. I kind of gave up on religion years ago. I went to a meeting, and there was this man who spoke, and it dawned on me who it was, and it was the guy who's, I don't know where Bob B originally came from, but it was Bob B, and he spoke about the second step. And he said something to the effect that the book, the step two does not say we came to, we say we came to believe, we don't come to know. And this very day, I just still come to believe. I'm still coming to believe. Each and every day, I come to believe that I'm not, and the one thing I believe today now is I'm not God. I cannot handle this alone. And I had to find a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And the only thing I could count on was the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. And when I took a look at my life and a real hard look, I realized that I felt like a failure all my life because I didn't live up to my family's expectations and whatnot. And I'm realizing that there's no bigger waste than trying to live up to someone else's expectations of you, including yourself. So, and that was why I came from my first, fourth, and fifth, was probably my first NA, fourth, and fifth step. And one of my biggest character defects, to this very day, is my inconsolable perfectionism. And if it isn't perfect, I just stop, and I just will not proceed on. And then I realized, you know, if you, the minute you stop, you still have a, you know, getting your shit. There's a great line I heard years ago was like, when you get your shit together, what you have is a whole big pile of shit that you got together. Now, what are you going to do with it? And, you know, when I realized when I don't have to, I have, you know, perfectionism means that you know it all. And one thing I've learned in recovery is I do not know it all. And that helped me let go. When I made my first amends to my family, it was really awkward and I didn't do it right because I didn't ask for suggestions of how to do it. But the one thing I do know is in the eighth and ninth step is you have to learn to forgive those that harmed you in the eighth step. And then the ninth step is about you forgiving yourself for doing those harms. And you do that with love, and you can do that with compassion. And they don't have to love you back. And it's and the ninth step is for you. It's for you, not them. I wish I did more of a tenth step every day. I mean, I probably did. If I do one a month, I'm pretty good, you know. And that woman taught me how to just take time to be quiet. And it was really hard. I thought quiet meant that I had to kind of get Zen and do Om and whatnot. And the things I learned from that is, you know, quiet isn't necessarily silence, but silencing your mind. For me, I'm not telling you what to do. Sometimes you don't, the noise, the background noise is just like the John Cage piece where the music comes from the noise that is emanating from the audience. And then you realize that you're a part of the greater whole. And that's what I get from that. And this 12th step, you know, I will just tell you, I do as much service as I can. I try to carry the message, but I have to carry the message as I understand it. So I'm getting rushed. I'm probably going on, and I told myself I wasn't going to try to speak more than 30 minutes. I'm probably past that now. Somewhere along the way, I met my current partner, and the official thing was I ran into him, and I asked him, "Where are you from?" And he told me Scotland, and like, oh. Or it's like, are you British? He told me he was Scottish, and I told him, well, what's the difference? Because this is my naivety going on. So I immensely fell head over heels in something. Chased him halfway around the world. And the short and long of it is, I moved to Scotland 4 years after I met him. And 4 years later, we got married. And let me tell you, if nothing else, I practiced my program with him more than any other person I ever met in my life. You know, and the funniest thing was when I met, I don't know how I got on. Oh, yeah, I met my sponsor on Facebook. And he told me about these online meetings. I was visiting San Francisco back in 2013. And all the meetings were kind of waning down, my old home groups. One of them was the Young People's Meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, and that completely died. It didn't no longer exist. I couldn't think of it. A lot of the meetings didn't exist anymore. So I needed a meeting, and I remember Steve telling me about his online meeting, that the Highlands and Islands meetings, and I went to that meeting when I was there, and how great that was. And a few years later, maybe I came back to these meetings and the Highlands online meetings, and I felt one more time at home. When I moved to Edinburgh, I didn't feel quite at home here, and it took a while to feel at home, find people in my arsenal to feel at home with. But you know, the funniest thing was one of my closest friends happens to live in Norway. And if it wasn't for the internet, I probably would not have that connection with that person. And he's a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And he couldn't be more different from me, and yet we couldn't be more the same. And the funniest thing was, since I've been clean here, I do not have the same anger I used to. You know, what 32 years has taught me is I'm 32 years clean. And I have a lot to learn, and I have a lot of mistakes to make. You know, since I've been clean, I lost both my parents in recovery. I lost a few jobs. I had to make some major moves in my life. And I did not have to pick up over any of those things. I got all my bucket lists. I went to Paris. I got on a game show, went a trip to Florence. And because this person that I told you about, this Norwegian guy that I met, he convinced me to go to meetings in Montenegro. And I did not know where in Pogorica, Montenegro, my very first Adriatic convention. And I asked him, where the fuck is Pogorica? And he's like, okay, I'll go. And I did go. And let me tell you, there was a wonderful fellowship there. It was a very small convention, but I remember how welcomed I felt there, and how people made me feel welcomed. You know, for a long time I was different and I wasn't accepted. And because this fellowship, from the bikers in Sacramento, California, to the addicts who live in the former Yugoslavian states, accept me. You know, I'm accepted. And the one core reason why I keep going back to meetings was one of my old sponsors, Diane, told me that third tradition states the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. You can go any fucking where you want, Michael, regardless of what other people say to you. And if they have a problem with you, they can leave. And let me tell you, there were many meetings where they had a problem with me, but I didn't leave. So if you're new here, you don't have to leave before the miracle happens, because, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens. And if you don't realize that you are here now, is that you are a miracle. If no one told you they loved you today, well, I love you. And I do not want you to change unless you want to do so. Narcotics Anonymous has given me one of the greatest gifts I've ever received. It gave me first the gift of desperation, and today I have the gift of opportunity. And I don't always use that gift of opportunity, but when I do, it's always there for me. So I think I rambled on way too long, but I really do love all of you. Thank you for allowing me to share. Thank you guys for being here. And mostly, thank Mrs. Cornwell, wherever you are, for letting me have 32 years, 50, and coming up to 58 years of life. I realized that, you know, a few years ago, you know, I thought I was not going to make 30 years of age, and today I'm over 30 years clean. I don't know how the fuck that happened, but it happened. So I'm grateful for all the opportunity. And now I will pass.